Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to a mid-July edition of the VanCast, and much like the Seattle Mariners in their dominance over the Toronto Blue Jays, we have really, really good relief pitching here because our starter, Thomas Drantz, top of the lineup guy, is dealing with COVID in Montreal. Now, we're not sure if he's actually just trying to extend his Montreal trip because, you know, who wouldn't want to spend more time there because it's such a wonderful city, or we're not sure if he's just devastated by the four-game sweep of his Blue Jays by my Mariners that have them now tied for the final wildcard playoff spot in the American League. Yes, I know it's July, but that doesn't matter. If you're a Mariner fan, you take the celebration when you can. Paul Sewald joins us. Oh, wait. No, it's Diego Castillo. No. It is Harmon Dial, my good friend, stepping out of the bullpen to take down all topics that is Vancouver Canucks. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. I'm ready to spit 95 mile per hour heat.
Yeah, you know, and for you, it's not just all heat. I mean, generally, you've got a wide array of pitches.
Yeah, I can throw some curveballs in there. I've got a good slider, but I like it high and inside. I like pitching there.
Yeah, you know what? Because the only thing that was wrong with this weekend was the Drancer wasn't here to actually go to Seattle to enjoy it. So, you know, but he's in Montreal, which is a good place to be, a place that still should have a Major League Baseball team. And I know one of our producers, Jeff Demet, is going to be hearing the start of this podcast, and he's just going to be losing his mind because he's also a Toronto lover, Blue Jay lover, Toronto resident. So tough on you, Jeff. Chip and myself and Harm, we're West Coast people. So West Coast, Best Coast. We're into the Mariners. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about the reason why we're here for the VanCast, and that is the Vancouver Canucks, before every Jays fans jump ships and hits stop and gets to another podcast. You know, we talked about the draft. We did our post day one of the draft live room, and certainly the JT Miller discussion around the New York Islanders and what did or didn't happen in the hours leading up to the first pick. We still don't have any clarity on what happened there. Both sides are still being quiet. We've certainly got some reports about what plausibly could have happened. Canucks are still denying any involvement, vehemently denied it to Drancer when we talked last Thursday. And, you know, just generally, there was a lot of quiet around the Vancouver Canucks. Yes, that was certainly something that took up a lot of oxygen. But when you look at the overall performance of a management team that has, you know, impressed, not like big time impressed in terms of significant moves, but, you know, they've nibbled around the edges, and certainly getting the Brock Besser extension done was a tidy bit of business. But, you know, we talked about a JT Miller trade. There was discussion of a Tyler Myers trade. More than anything, there was discussion about trying to create cap flexibility in and around the draft, and also adding some picks, right? Because we knew this is a team that has just gutted itself of picks in recent years. So there was talk of trying to maybe add a second round pick, or, you know, maybe moving down in the first round because some of their top guys were still available, and adding draft capital with that type of decision. None of it happened. So what do you make of how quiet the Canucks ultimately were on draft weekend?
Yeah, it was pretty surprising to me because, again, we've heard, I think, a lot of rhetoric with this management group about them understanding how many different areas they want to improve in, right? They've been blunt and honest about the fact that the team relied a lot on goaltending, about how they want to get faster, about how they would like to add sandpaper, about how they want to open up cap flexibility, and they've got this big Miller decision, and obviously there's still time to address those things, but based off of what management has been saying, and certainly what, if you sort of read between the lines in the lead up to this offseason, we've expected some fireworks this offseason, really. And again, there's time to accomplish those things, but it was really quiet. And it's not just the lack of moves, but I think it's, for me, it's the fact that it didn't seem like there was a whole lot of activity, period. And what I mean by that is, for example, it, at the 2019 draft, which was the only other event I've covered, only other draft I've covered in person, I remember even on day one when the Canucks didn't make a move, there was still tons of chatter. There was still tons of buzz and speculation around, looks like the Canucks are up to something. And ultimately, they didn't end up making a day one move. But then, of course, on the day two, they swung that big splash for JT Miller. And it just felt like they were on the cusp of making a big move. Whereas here, I mean, aside from the New York Islanders report, it didn't feel like there was a whole lot of buzz, or it didn't feel like they were on the cusp of getting something significant done. And so to me, it's not even just related to the Miller thing. As you kind of mentioned, it would have been nice for them if they had found a way to kind of clear some cap space, which opens up more doors, opportunities, avenues over the next few days. Of course, the draft picks thing, whether it would have been draft picks for this year or next year. I think, of course, the big one is kind of like we've been talking about for a long time here, the Miller decision. And I think there's a camp of people kind of bring up the idea of patience and kind of sticking up for kind of the price that you feel is right. And I definitely do get the sense that that's how management has been playing things. And people kind of bring up the Matt Duchene example of look how patient Joe Sakic and the Colorado Avalanche were with the Matt Duchene decision. And they ultimately held out and got what they wanted. And the difference there, of course, is Duchene had 2 years of term left, right? Like Sakic didn't wait until Duchene's final year before kind of pulling the trigger. So yes, Sakic was patient, but he also had a lot more time and leverage than the Canucks do right now. And there is, in my opinion, there's risk to hanging on too long, especially if you're holding on to him midseason. Because if you look at past comps for top line guys that have been traded at the deadline, they typically haven't fetched full value. I mean, I think of someone like Mark Stone. All he went for was Eric Brandstrom in a second round pick. And that same deadline, Matt Duchene, ironically, was scoring at a 45 goal, 94 point pace. Ottawa traded him to Columbus as a rental, and they picked up first round pick and change. So to me, if the Canucks want to sort of maximize, if they decide, hey, trading JT Miller is the best course of action, I think they've got to do it, in my opinion, this offseason. I think there's risk if you sort of bring him back. And it's a tough one, though. And I'm not going to sit here and sort of criticize or rip management for not having made a move yet, because there's still tons of time. Free agency hasn't even opened yet. And there will be, for example, teams that see how the UFA market unfolds, whether certain guys like Goudreau hit the market, and teams may be circling back. So there's still tons of opportunity to get things done. But it has been a little bit surprising. The one thing I will say is I don't think the forward market has worked in the Canucks' favor as it pertains to sort of making this proactive decision on Miller. Of course, DeBrincat didn't go for much, right? Seventh overall pick and some change there, which for a player of DeBrincat's caliber, I mean, 24 years old, and over the last 2 years, only five players have scored more goals than DeBrincat. Four of those guys have won Hart trophies, and the other is Kirill Kaprizov. For DeBrincat to be that young and that coveted and have that kind of team control and to only go for that type of return, I mean, if you're a Canucks fan, that's underwhelming in terms of what Chicago netted. And what's interesting too is when you have markets where, like, let's look at the goalie market, for example, there are way more bidders than there are sort of available goalies. And because of that, what you see is teams are moving quickly to get their guys, right? Like Detroit really jumped the gun to go after and get Ville Husso. You look at Washington with New Jersey with Vitek Vanecek. and teams are just they're moving Colorado with Georgiev. They're moving quickly to get their players done because they don't see a lot of availability. Whereas I think with the forward market, I think teams kind of think they have options and can sort of afford to be patient. So I'm sure that hasn't helped the Canucks' case. But yeah, I mean, it was surprising for me that we haven't seen any dominoes, whether it be Miller or even some of the other guys. We haven't really seen management put their stamp on this team yet.
Yeah, no, we haven't. And there's still time because I think there's a feeling that once you get into the first day or two of free agency and certain teams may not be able to get what they want. And there aren't a lot of guys like Miller available at that time anyway, right? I mean, you can certainly debate the merits of Geno Malkin and there's a few others. But, you know, I don't know that there's going to be a lot of players that have the ability to impact the way JT Miller has. So what do you do, right? And I think they feel that at that point, some leaves may shake loose and someone's going to be a little bit desperate to get something done and there's still time. And, you know, I know they talk about bringing him back to training camp. Boy, I think that would be a huge mistake. And not that I've got any criticism of the player himself, but you can't get into a situation where you get to next year's deadline and you're still within a whisper of a playoff spot and now you can't make a move and now he walks for nothing. Right? Like you just can't do that. And the one thing that's pretty clear is the longer they wait and the pressure points, whether they're real or imagined, whether the club believes they're real or imagined, as long as those pressure points start getting checked off, ultimately more leverage goes to the player if they do want to get a contract done. And I'm not suggesting getting a contract done is the worst thing, but I think it'd be a real bad idea for them to go into the season. I mean, maybe there's a world where they believe all of a sudden he's going to have a mediocre first half to the season and they can somehow regain some leverage. But is that what you want in that moment, right? Like a mediocre performance, a player that's probably disgruntled. If JT Miller's playing mediocre hockey, that means he's a grumpy guy. And that means that, you know, that all the positive impact he has in the room probably turns a little bit negative from time to time because he knows the contract situation is out there weighing on him and weighing on the club. And, you know, he's going to feel a level of uncertainty. I mean, you can mark my words, if they have to wait until the deadline and, you know, he sits there and gets traded or doesn't get traded, he will talk about, much like he did last season, about how the dialogue around the deadline affected him and others, right? I mean, they talked about that last year. JT Miller talked about that the day after the deadline. Right? Brock Besser talked about that the day after the deadline. You do not want this to get to that point for anybody's sake. You simply don't want that. So as much as they say, oh yeah, you know, we're fine. You know, the reality is there's still a lot of dialogue around the player. Darren Dreger has reported it. Kevin Weeks has reported it that, yeah, they are still in active trade discussions. Nothing imminent, nothing deep, but yeah, the conversations are still happening. Teams are still reaching out, you know, and maybe some teams believe that they've got a little more, you know, when you get that close to the draft, it does become easier to fall in love with a specific player. And now you're like, well, you know, we'll trade next year's pick. We're going to be much better next year. And so now we're likely going to trade a lower pick, you know, in order to get JT Miller. Kind of everybody's of that mindset. So, you know, there's going to be conversations continuing. And, you know, can you imagine JT Miller on the first day of training camp having to discuss this issue? You know, and then having to go through it over and over. I mean, we know what an emotional player he is. And you, look, we both like JT. Like, well, you know, I certainly haven't had an axe to grind or got into it with him. I like the guy. And you know, he's fun in certain environments, right? So, but coming in a training camp and, like, he's not a player that holds a lot back. If he's pissed off about a situation, he's going to let you know about it. And if he's tired of hearing about a certain situation, he's going to let you know about it. So, it would be interesting to see what would happen. And I think it would be a mistake for the Canucks to get to training camp in September and still have this situation weighing over them.
Agreed. And there are a couple of things that I'm kind of watching for in terms of if you're going to sort of go down the trade route this offseason in terms of things that could affect the Canucks' return. And I've written about a couple of these things recently when I tried to kind of weigh what Miller's potential trade value could be. One is how many teams out there, and this is something that I'm curious, and it's been tough to peg down. How many teams would view JT Miller as a core piece where you look at him and you go, let's trade for him and extend him right away, versus how many teams would look at him instead as, hey, he's making $5.25 million for one more year. Let's just
depends
get him
what
as
you
a
give up,
rental.
Though. It depends what you've got to give up. I mean, teams aren't going to give up what the Canucks want for a one-year player.
No, well, that's what I'm saying, right? And that's where for the Canucks to maximize their return, for them to really get the package that they want, I think they need or should be hoping that there are as many teams as possible out there that view Miller as more than just a one-year rental, right? Because you can talk about, let's say, a team like the Carolina Hurricanes. I'm sure that with the way that they were unable to score goals against the New York Rangers in the playoffs for a second consecutive season, scoring being an issue, Rod Brind'Amour sort of lamenting the fact that they don't have an elite goal scorer, I'm sure they'd love the idea of adding a piece like JT Miller. But the way the Canes do business, I would seriously doubt whether they would view him as anything more than a one-year rental. Same thing with Colorado. I'm sure the Avs would love the idea of adding JT Miller as a potential Nazem Kadri replacement. But again, it would kind of be, in my opinion, based off the cap situation and the mega extension it would take to retain Miller long-term, I'm sure they'd have doubts about extending him. Or else I'm sure they would have already gone down, say, the Nazem Kadri route. So I think that is something that I'm kind of keeping an eye on, especially as we hear kind of conflicting reports and lots of speculation about, are the Canucks willing to grant teams permission to speak with Miller's camp? And is Miller's camp sort of gaining some sort of control from that dynamic? And then the other thing to kind of keep an eye on is, of course, everything is supply and demand. How many other forwards are realistically going to be available, right? Like, if you're the Canucks, I think you're hoping that Johnny Gaudreau stays in Calgary. So you at least have one more sort of elite game-changing forward stay off the market. But besides that, right, what's going to happen with Patrick Kane now that the Chicago Blackhawks have blown everything up, right? Are the Hawks going to all of a sudden be okay with the idea of retaining salary and potentially facilitating a trade there? Vladimir Tarasenko still hasn't rescinded his trade request, right? Are the Blues comfortable still holding on to him? Obviously, tons of buzz in Winnipeg about Pierre-Luc Dubois saying, hey, I'm going to test free agency reportedly in 2024. And Mark Scheifele as well. He sort of questioned his long-term future in Winnipeg. And our colleague at The Athletic, Murat, sort of mentioned that there were preliminary trade discussions with Scheifele. Boston's got to figure out if they can sort of, Pasternak's in the same situation as Miller in terms of being a UFA at the end of next season. They're going to obviously try and move heaven and earth to resign him. But if they can't, then they're not going to let him go for nothing either. And so, again, if you're the Canucks, you're hoping that as few of these players as possible become available.
Yeah, a lot of good, a lot of other dominoes and a lot of other things that are going to affect what winds up happening on the JT Miller front. But certainly a lot of active dialogue. And for me, I'm still going to be hugely surprised if we're having this discussion in the next couple of weeks. I think this thing has to get done. I think it's going to get done. And I think the longer they wait, the more difficult it gets to get done.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So as the Canucks gear towards the 13th, which is day one, I keep feeling like it's Canada Day. I get told by the network every year, you can't do anything on Canada Day. I'm thinking, that's a long weekend. But we haven't been able to. So here we are, the 13th. So the league pushing it back because of a COVID delayed season has helped us all have a July 1st. But here we are, July 13th, and the Canucks, they still want to improve, right? Like, they haven't done a lot of it to this point in terms of meaningful improvements. They want to find ways to get better. We've talked about the areas where they need help. We've talked about a right shot top four defenseman. We've talked about help in the top nine as far as forwards go. If they move from JT Miller, potentially a top six, whether that's a center or a winger is going to be determined by what they wind up doing with JT Miller. So there's a number of areas they need to go. Where are some logical places for them to look?
Yeah, it's interesting. I want to actually start with an RFA that really sort of sticks out to me. And I've kind of mentioned this name before, but Nicholas Waugh out of Vegas, Jesse Granger recently, who covers the Golden Knights, wrote an article about how Vegas is in a really tough cap bind with their RFAs that require arbitration rights. And Waugh was making $750,000 right around the league minimum, and now he's an RFA with arb rights, and he had a really good year, so he's in line for a significant raise. And because Vegas has already reportedly reached an agreement in place with Riley Smith on an extension, they don't have a lot of cap flexibility. So that's where I look at Waugh. He's a 6'4" right shot centerman, right? So right away you're checking off a couple of pivotal boxes there. And here's a guy who I've liked Waugh for a long time. I sort of watched him play and figured that this is a guy that could sort of break out with greater opportunity. And he finally sort of got more minutes this year, and sort of his production increased accordingly. He broke out with 15 goals and 39 points. He's a guy that has also killed penalties, brings a little bit of that sandpaper element you want. He's got underrated finesse and skill too with his hands, but he also sort of plays that high traffic, power forward sort of style. So to me, I look at a player like Waugh, he can play center, he can play wing, kills penalties, reliable two-way guy. He's 25 years old. And I think to myself, that's the perfect sort of player that the Canucks should be targeting. And of course, I mean, the easiest way, if you wanted to guarantee yourself in getting Nick Waugh, we of course don't see him happen very often, but it'd be the offer sheet. Like if you go out and you spend, say, like a $3.5 million cap hit, I doubt Vegas can afford that, and the compensation would only be a second round pick. But of course, if you don't want to go down that route, you can still use the leverage of an offer sheet threat to facilitate trade discussions, right? You can approach Vegas and say, hey, we're interested in Waugh. We know the offer sheet route is available. We'd prefer to work out a trade. And if not, and if we can't facilitate a trade, we're going to offer sheet your guy. And you can sort of figure something out there, because again, Vegas is, something's going to have to give. And they've got Laurent Brossoit as a sort of piece that I think they want to shed for cap space purposes. Like that's one of the avenues they're looking at. I wonder if they look at a player like Alec Martinez in terms of trying to shed cap space and bring some of their guys back. But you look at a player like Brossoit, a backup making a little bit over $2 million, he's injured right now. And I wonder if there would even realistically be a market for him. So they're in a tough spot there. So he kind of right off the bat sticks out to me as, you know, he's not a UFA, but he's the sort of player that I think could be available. And given his age and the type of boxes he checks, and I've long time been a fan of this player, I think he makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. You know, and I'm trying to get a sense of how open Alvin would be to the offer sheet concept, because we talk about that every year. And Benning wasn't going there. He was simply too old school to go there. And, you know, you'd have to think Jim Rutherford is probably a lean that way, but depending on how much latitude he gives Alvin, I don't know that he's that guy. I wonder if he would take advantage of that tool, because so few GMs are willing to do it, and it makes so much sense. I mean, you know, it made sense when, you know, we were, who's the defenseman in Tampa?
Chernak.
Yeah, Eric Chernak. Like, you know, a logical piece that you could have got for a number. Now, he may have wanted to go back there anyway, and they're finding ways to take care of him. It's certainly, you know, a team that has that level of success, it's hard to pry a player away from, but give the option, put it out there, make it hard. And they just were so unwilling to do that. Do you get the sense that this management team is any more willing to go there?
Yeah, I do legitimately wonder if they'd consider it in a way where I didn't think it was possible for the last management regime. Now, do I think that that's, you know, they're looking ahead at the at this upcoming RFA deadline and whenever they're eligible to make offer sheets and thinking, let's really get to work. No, I don't think that's their top priority or the first way that they look at improving this roster. But I also do think that they recognize, and this is an important point, the Canucks are in a spot where they're trying to juggle two priorities, where they're not only trying to build long-term for the future and trying to get this project on track to becoming a contender, but they also can't just sit here and rebuild and trade away all their good players and not care about what kind of team or really care what kind of roster they ice for the next couple of seasons. And you know, maybe next season isn't a big priority, but they still, whether it's 2 years from now or 3 years from now, they don't have a lot of time, I think, to kind of right this ship. And when you're balancing two priorities like that, I think that means you have to think outside of the box. You have to be bold. You have to be aggressive, because it's a tough needle to kind of thread if you're the Vancouver Canucks. And the other thing to kind of keep in mind is, especially with a team like Vegas, usually one of the biggest reasons teams are wary of offer sheets is this idea of retribution. If we go after one of their guys, they're then going to go after one of our guys. And the thing with Vegas is I can't see them ever really having the cap space to meaningfully take a run at any of Vancouver's prized RFAs down the line. And again, even if you're, let's say, not bold enough to go the offer sheet route, you can just still use that as leverage. You can act like you're fully serious about it. And if you want a more amicable solution, just use that as leverage to kind of facilitate trade discussion. So whether or not they actually make an offer sheet itself, even if they just use the threat of it for some of these players around the league to open up trade possibilities, I think they've got to use that. I just think the Canucks are in a spot where they've got to use every tool, every avenue to them. They've got to at least seriously consider it in order to kind of upgrade this roster for the short and long term.
Another player that you mentioned was Colin White as an intriguing target. What do you think in terms of a bargain free agent addition?
Yeah, I like Colin White. And here's a guy who the Sens obviously bought him out because it was a unique situation where the one-thirds rule still applied, where in most buyout situations, you're still owed two-thirds of the cap hit and the salary. But because of White's age, the Sens were only on the hook for one-third. So it made a lot of sense for them to kind of move on from White in his bloated contract. But here's a guy who he scored at a 36-point pace per 82 games over his NHL career. And when you look at the way the last few years have gone, he sort of strikes me as the sort of player that makes a ton of sense as a reclamation project, because I believe it was the 18-19 season, I want to say, where he scored 41 points in 71 games when playing with Mark Stone and Brady Tkachuk. But afterwards, he never really had a chance with offensively talented linemates, right? Stone was dealt that year at the deadline, so he went. And then with the emergence of Josh Norris and Tim Stützle over the last couple of years, White just kind of slid back the lineup and, you know, didn't really play with Brady Tkachuk anymore. And so you look at his most common linemates at 5-on-5 over the last 3 years, there were Tyler Ennis and Nick Paul. And look, Ennis and Paul aren't bad players, and Paul especially has a lot of two-way value, but those guys aren't gifted offensive players. And so you take that away from him. You add injuries to the mix. White, I should say, has been really banged up and missed quite a bit of time. And then I think the coaching staff also just, as a result, kind of lost faith and confidence where White was healthy scratch in and out of the lineup. And I don't think you can underestimate the type of mental toll that can have on a player where all of a sudden you're doubting your abilities, and it can be a real, real hit to your confidence. And what we know about offense and making a high level impact is so much of it flows on being able to play on your instincts, about being able to play with confidence, not second guessing yourself. And that's where you look at White's situation in Ottawa the last few years. I think it was just a really difficult situation, and I think it's great for him to have a chance to hit the reset button. And with White, he's also a pretty reliable two-way player. I don't know if I mentioned it, but he's also a right-shot centerman. And I'm actually surprised the Sens hadn't to this point given him a penalty-killing opportunity because he is a pretty detail-oriented player. And there was some chatter about that, I remember, a few years ago, about should Colin White earn some PK reps. So here's a guy who it kind of strikes me a little bit like the Alex Wennberg when Columbus bought him out, right? It was a similar sort of situation where Columbus and Ottawa both see this talented middle six centerman. They bet long with the contract, and then whether it was injuries or things just kind of not working out, it fizzled out. And the guy needed a fresh start, and Wennberg ended up going to Florida on a pretty cheap deal. And it was an impact driver for them in the 2020-21 season. And I sort of see a similar potential with Colin White if he can stay healthy.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
So some interesting options there. Let's work backwards a little bit. You know, we talked about what didn't happen at the draft and, you know, the patience that the organization is showing at this point and not overreacting or not paying too much or getting back too little for what their assets currently are. But as far as the draft itself is concerned and who they did pick day two and beyond, you know, a lot of talk about Elias Pettersson just because of the name. But take me through who intrigues you the most about the Canucks' day two picks and who you think might have a shot to play at the next level eventually.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple there that stand out. Obviously, you mentioned Elias Pettersson, and I think I really like that pick in the third round. And industry-wide, I think a lot of teams liked that pick for Vancouver because Pettersson, I think, he's a sort of player that maybe goes overlooked because he doesn't have a flashy sort of side to him. He plays a pretty simple game, but here's a guy who he's a good in zone defender. He defends the rush well. He's 6'2" and he's got some meanness to him. Like, I think he's the sort of defenseman who once he fills out, he's going to be 205-210, and he's going to be the sort of players that forwards don't like going in the corners with, which the Canucks really do need more of. And he held his own in the SHL too, which I think for a young defenseman who's a first year draft eligible is pretty impressive. And what intrigues me the most about Pettersson is he's got the combination of having the good size, but he's also a plus skater, right? Four-way mobility, he moves well. And to be able to nab a player in the third round who has SHL experience at the highest level already, who has above average size and can also skate really well, to have those types of physical properties in a player you select in the third round, I thought that was great value. Now, of course, the upside isn't super high because he's a simple player. I don't ever think that he's going to be, say, like a top-notch puck mover or the type of guy who's going to bring a lot of offense to the table. But he has a pretty high floor, in my opinion. And if he can be, you know, one day down the line, a bottom pair defenseman who can kill penalties for you, defend the rush well, and can really excel in a lot of those defensive aspects, and maybe even has, if everything goes right, maybe even has some sneaky second pair upside, then that's, I think, a great pick for the Canucks there. The other one that kind of intrigues me, not because I know a lot about him, but because of what I've heard from others, Ty Young. I've been told Ian Clark loves Ty Young. He's the guy that Ian wanted, and the Canucks got him. Now, obviously, when the Canucks sort of make the decision to draft a goaltender, it's not as if Ian Clark walks up to the draft table and is like, we're picking that guy. It's a collaborative process. The scouts are involved. Management is involved. But again, my understanding is Ian Clark really, really likes Ty Young. And you look at Young, he has good size. He helped the Prince George Cougars once Ty Brennan went down with injury into the playoffs. He's 6'3", so he's got some good size, and he's also one of the youngest players of the draft class in terms of when he turns 18, and that's always, I think, an underrated thing that people don't talk enough about, in my opinion, is a lot of times the guy's only a month or two away from being 2023 draft eligible, and when you think about 17 or 18-year-old prospects, 10 months can make a huge difference in a player's development. And that also applies with Jonathan Lekaramäki, right? He's also one of the youngest players of this year's draft crop. And so those are, I think, a couple of exciting notes. And after that, I wasn't as big a fan of, say, the Gardner picks in Dorrington, but Pettersson and Young kind of caught my eye.
And of course, we're going to see Lekkerimäki at Prospects Camp this week at UBC. So camp begins today and it'll continue until the end of the week. Names that are of interest to you, I'm going to try to get out there tomorrow. I don't know if you'll be there today out at UBC. But for me, you know, Lekkerimäki is the obvious one. I want to see Linus Karlsson. And just the fact that, you know, he had a fairly good season in the SHL and just kind of how close he is, because given his age now, that time is coming. You know, they're talking about him getting some games in Vancouver this year. So I definitely want to see how close he potentially is right now. The other guy that I want to take a look at is Aiden McDonough, because, you know, we talked a lot about where he stood last year and the fact that they didn't get him signed. And now, you know, but they still feel pretty confident that they can. Yes, he's going back, but everyone's saying the right things, and just kind of how he's treated and what his development curve looks like right now, you know, may lead to something down the road here, potentially as early as this year. Those two jump out at me because I tend to take a more short-term view on these guys, but I know you follow the draft a lot closer than I do, so you might be thinking more long-term in terms of who you want to get a look at.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be interested to see, you know, obviously Karlsson, as you kind of mentioned, but Filip Johansson as well, right? He's a right shot D prospect, and the Canucks don't have enough of them. And he, of course, was drafted in the first round. He was a reach there in terms of being taken that early. And I don't think his development has been stellar since he's been drafted. But the Canucks, we know, and they, of course, the draft came and went, and they weren't able to add a right shot defenseman, which, you know, it isn't ideal, but you also kind of understand because they really wanted to prioritize taking the best player available. But given their inability to add RD prospects at the draft, I'm that much more interested to see where Johansson's at in his development. And of course, Karlsson really sticks out to me because we know the eye-popping numbers that he had, 26 goals and 46 points in 52 games in the SHL. I believe he was breaking some records for age-related production, but he's a sort of player type too, where specifically I want to see where his skating is at, because with Karlsson, I think we know he has a good shot. He was sort of drafted initially, I think, as having some intriguing two-way tools and playing a detail-oriented game and being a responsible 200-foot player. But the skating has always been the biggest question mark with him, especially in a North American setting where the pace of play really improves, and that's also going to dictate whether or not he's a center prospect or whether he's a wing prospect. And for a Canucks system that that lacks high-end centermen as well, in terms of what's coming next in the prospect pipeline, it'd be great if Karlsson could develop into a center prospect, even if he's only a bottom six piece down the line. Especially, again, he's a right shot guy, and I know we've talked about it so much, but the Canucks really kind of have that need, so I'm going to be interested to see where Karlsson kind of stacks up in terms of his skating specifically. So there's that. And then also Danila Klimovich. We've heard Ryan Johnson speak a lot about how he expects Klimovich to make big strides going into his second AHL campaign. And it was an interesting up and down campaign for him, where Klimovich was hot right out of the gate in October, but then he did not have a great run at things in terms of his production, kind of flatlined. He wasn't getting, I think, a lot of minutes, and there were some growing pains in terms of the all around details. And so, with, you know, obviously, I think training camp is going to be a better representation of the progress that he's made. But Klimovich, to me, is another prospect to kind of keep an eye on.
Yeah, again, a player that you'd think is a little bit closer just based on age when he was selected. You know, the interesting part with Karlsson is people, even in the SHL, you know, have talked a little bit about his strength in his own end. And he's 22 years old. He's still not yet 180. You know, you'd think that he would have developed a little bit more in that way physically. But yet, when you look at him on film, he still looks like a very young player that still has a ways to go in that area. And I know that sounds like an old school thought, you know, and we talked about Elias Pettersson, and he was able to function because he had a lot of practical strength, if not obvious weight related strength. I don't see the same things in Karlsson.
That's an interesting one, because I mean, it's tough to tell with the tape, but actually sort of thought that Carlson, at least from viewing him on video a couple times here and there, that he was, he didn't strike me as a thin player, is kind of what I'm getting at. And I mean, Elite Prospects has him listed at 194 pounds. So
I think the Canucks have him listed at 179. So
I think that's Hockey DB. So I don't know. I'd be curious to know how. It's really weird how in the NHL there or in hockey in general, there isn't really like a standardized way of knowing a guy's weight. So I guess that's one thing we're also going to kind of be keeping an eye on.
With Lakira Mackey, the Canucks and Giants had him not only listed with different heights, but different ages.
Yeah,
in their releases. One of them had him at 17, not 18.
Yeah, I think, you know, just based off rule of thumb, I think whatever, you know, I don't know how Hockey DB and these sites get fed their measurements, but usually in my experience, Hockey DB, like I tend to lean towards Elite Prospects, but I guess we're going to see, right? And that's where camp is also so useful, because I remember a guy like Jack Rathbone, he wasn't listed as being very big and he was sort of discussed as this undersized defenseman. And yeah, he doesn't have ideal size, but you know, the conversation about him, you'd think Jack Rathbone was Quinn Hughes in terms of how small he was.
Yeah, he's then, not that. He's thicker for sure.
Exactly. So that's where in person, you know, whatever height and weight he's listed at doesn't really matter as much, I think, as much as how he looks when we actually see him in person. So I guess we'll just kind of have to make that judgment whenever we get out to UBC.
Boy, I'll never forget the first camp that the first Elias Pettersson was out at UBC, and like literally he couldn't have been 160. Like he was just so, he looked like he was 13. And then, and I say that as the father of a 13-year-old, but obviously things have changed and he has managed to get stronger. But let's talk a little bit about, like, you know, as far as Klimovich, you know, there were times when he was just sitting and watching, but yet the club had a lot of good things to say about him. And wasn't necessarily a high pick, but the highest pick they had at that time. Is there pressure on the player at all, given how last year went and the inconsistencies of it?
I don't know if pressure is the right word, but there's definitely expectation. Again, we heard it with RJ. And the thing is with Klimovich, in terms of being a first-year AHL player at 18, 19 years old, it's a pretty rare thing. So I kind of expected bumps along the way, and the way that he kind of started so hot in October was actually kind of surprising to me, because even when you look at first round picks a lot of the time, and obviously a lot of that is complicated by, if you're drafted usually out of North America, you go back to major junior or the NCAA, or if you're a European prospect, you go back to your European league. So there just aren't a lot of players that consider the AHL right away anyway. But even then, it's just rare to kind of see a player that young, especially drafted, what was it, the third round or the second round, in an AHL setting right away. And I think the reason the Canucks sort of made that gamble was because they looked at Klimovich's physical package and they said the concern with prospects and them making the leap to professional hockey is we don't want them to get blasted physically. We don't want them to get hurt and have their confidence shot. Whereas I think they looked at Klimovich and being this big body already right around 200 pounds and thought, hey, he's ready for it. And the other thing too is with Klimovich, and this was apparent too in kind of watching the tape, and this is where you're hoping for, I think, more maturity, is pro habits and pro details were the biggest sort of weaknesses that I think the organization wanted him to work on. And I think they sort of felt that, hey, if he's going back to junior, he can kind of cheat and have these shortcuts and score a ton of goals in junior and not necessarily have a lot of opportunity to, like, he may not be held as accountable as he was in, let's say, Abbotsford, where Trent Call was on him about back checking, about how he moves his feet away from the puck, about his two-way awareness, about the consistency and the effort level and the overall pro habits. And I think that's where, even like, forget the production, I think that's where they're going to be looking at, is he a more mature player than he was in his rookie season? And not to say that Klimovich was immature, but he was an 18, 19 year old kid who was very raw and sort of played over in Belarus. And that's not the most structured sort of environment. And he has that little bit of JT Miller in him as far as the temper and the frustration. So I think for him to earn more trust and for him to, like, everyone looks at the production, right? And I think that's obviously what you look at in terms of, is this guy sort of making progress? But before he gets the opportunity to produce more, Klimovich, in my opinion, is going to have to show that he's willing to do a lot of that hard work, a lot of that dirty work, that he's willing to just, that he's a more mature player than he was, because that's what's going to give him the trust to earn more minutes to then produce more. So that's I think what the organization's expectation is going to be of him. And yeah, I do think they have high expectations.
Quickly before we let you, actually not quickly, but before we let you go, this is the last one I want to get into, and that's Lekera Mäki. What is best for his development? Is it to go play in the Swedish league again, or is it to potentially come here and play junior for Vancouver in a more NHL-style environment, albeit with younger players, and just with the Canucks right there, being able to evaluate him constantly? Is there any upside to playing junior over playing against men in Sweden, given where he's at today?
Personally, I think, in my sense, is the organization likely feels the same way, is the Allsvenskan is probably the best way for him to go. Dujardin, it would have been nice if he had continued to have a chance in the SHL, but his club obviously got demoted. And look, I think that actually means a lot to him, that he's on a team where he's childhood friends with Noah Ustlund, who was also taken in the first round, and Liam Ogren, and so you look at the Swedish prospects, and they've spent years with these clubs. And Lekera Mäki, I believe he was 15 when he started with his SHL club, and there's a special bond that I think players have with their organizations. And Lekera Mäki, he didn't speak, you know, his English isn't very developed, but you could tell when he was asked about the opportunity to potentially go back to Sweden again and play for his club and help them get back into the SHL, he was like, Dujardin needs to be in the SHL. It would be special to help them get back to the SHL. So I think that opportunity means a ton for him. It's a comfortable environment. And compared to the WHL, he's at least going to still be playing with men, which I think is an advantage, because as a slight player, and this is where people would sort of say, would raise concerns about, he's a perimeter guy, and does he play on the inside? And those are valid questions and concerns to have. But he was still in the SHL, and he still scored 7 goals in, what was it, 26 games. So adapting in a pro setting, to me, is more important than getting used to the North American, the smaller rink and that sort of thing. So for me, I think it's best for his development to play in an environment where he's comfortable, where he is legitimately motivated, and where he's going to be playing against men.
Yeah, it does make sense. And that certainly has been on brand for this organization when they've had those opportunities to take them with a number of European-based players. And I'm sure that's the way they're going to wind up going here and what the players are going to want to do. But, you know, they talk about Lekera Mäki being at least, you know, 2, probably 3 years away from being a consideration here with the big club. And that's okay. The club needs to show that they've got enough in the prospect pool, or enough in the big club, that they can be patient with their prospects, which they certainly haven't shown to this point. We saw a lot of patience last week in and around the draft, but bigger picture, to see some of those top guys go through a development process, whether it be an additional year in Europe, whether it be some time in the American Hockey League, I think that's going to allow for prospects to hit the ground running a little bit more than what we've seen from time to time with the organization here. I mean, yeah, it might work for the Pettersons and Hughes, but there's so many others we could list off that it didn't necessarily work for, and some development time would absolutely have been beneficial. That's going to do it for us today.
Farhan, actually, one point that I wanted to make is something that I'm really kind of keeping an eye on going into the remainder of the offseason.
Yeah.
To me, I think I'm going to be really curious to see, is the club comfortable making decisions that potentially harm the roster short-term in order to build long-term? And the reason that that really sticks out to me is because, let's say you look at a long-term goal like building the blue line. I think we all know that if the Canucks ever want to be a legitimate Stanley Cup contender, capable of rivaling teams like Colorado, they really need a lot of young, high-end defensemen. And obviously, you look at their work in the draft. I like the Pettersson pick, but adding a third-round defender isn't really going to significantly move the needle there. And so we know, even in terms of, yeah, they have the need, they'd like to be able to acquire an established top four defender. But usually if you're doing that, you're overpaying in assets, right? You look at the Seth Jones trade, or the Islanders giving up the 13th for Alexander Romanov, or you're taking on a risky contract, or you're overpaying in free agency. So to me, that means one of the solutions for the Canucks to solve that need long term is you've got to acquire quality blue chip defense prospects. That probably involves trading a good player or two away, whether that's Miller or whether it's a Connor Garland or whoever you decide on. I think that's the route you kind of have to take in if you really want to address that long-term need. And then you sort of look at it and you go, obviously, if you're trading a JT Miller or if you're trading Connor Garland, you're obviously making your roster weaker for next season. That's something you have to be okay with. It's kind of like sacrificing piece in chess, right? In chess, you want to hoard as many good pieces as possible. You want as many of them alive as possible. But sometimes you're in a position where you look at the board, you think and strategize multiple steps ahead and say, if my next move is to protect all my next pieces at all costs, I'm not putting myself in a good tactical position to win the game long term. And I'm looking at the chessboard that the Canucks have in front of them. They need to sacrifice a piece or two to gain that stronger long-term tactical position, because some people, they play chess, they never want to lose a decent piece. They're never willing to sacrifice. And so unless they play a perfect game, they never win. And that's, I think, that was the fundamental issue, I think, with the last management regime, was they went, hey, we want to build for the future, but they were never willing to sacrifice the roster's, you know, short-term health to help it long-term. The last regime wanted to win the chess game without ever sacrificing any pieces on the board. And it's just so hard to win that way. And that's what this current regime is going to be tested on right now, in my opinion, is are you okay with taking a step back on paper today for the better good of tomorrow? Because again, I think the Canucks are in a spot where to address some of these long-term roster needs, you're going to have to sacrifice a piece or two and make some tough decisions.
Yeah, and it's simple enough to say, okay, well, they're going to move on from JT Miller. That indicates that they are, but what do they do with it, right? Because you don't want to wind up signing somebody, because they've still talked about, yeah, we want to be in the playoffs this year, and that certainly becomes a mandate from ownership. So, okay, you move JT Miller, but if you now all of a sudden have to bring in a piece that you're not sure about, but you've got to pay too much, and we're not talking about, you know, some of the Antoine Roussel-type moves, like they're not going to be that ridiculous, but you don't want to put yourself in a situation where you can't fix your cap long term, right? Because if you look at it on paper right now, for today, they're in position to add meaningful pieces. But what's it going to cost you to do that in terms of term? And are you going to compromise yourself going forward? So, you know, we know they're going to add some, if they move on from JT Miller, it's not like they're just going to get young. They're going to add some pieces that are going to cost them for this year. I fully expect that to happen. But how much term do they give those prospects in order to make that work? And how much does that compromise them going forward? That's the bigger concern.
Yeah.
But
no point trading Miller and, let's say, overpaying for Kadri and free agency.
Absolutely. Perfect example. On that note, we're going to wrap this one up. Paul Maurice of the Florida Panthers and Pierre LeBrun joined Craig Custance and Sean Gentile on the eve of free agency Tuesday on the Athletic Hockey Show. As for us, we're going to be back on Wednesday night for a live room edition where we react to the first day of free agency. Hopefully the Canucks have some involvement in that so we can talk about it. And here's going to be a treat for all of you. Kevin Bieksa is going to join us as part of that live room, which will go around 6 o'clock on Wednesday night. So please be sure to tune in. Drancer and I will post the link just before we go on air, as we always do. Bieksa is going to join us. He's not as smart as Harmon Dial, even though he's quick to tell us he's a college guy. But nonetheless, we're going to have some fun with him, so that'll be good. As for us, thanks for listening to the VanCast. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. Right now, you can get an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. Harm, thanks for doing this. Thanks for pitching in and pinch hitting. Actually, no, you were the relief pitcher. We pulled you out of the bullpen with Drancer down and out. We'll see you out at UBC this week.
Yeah, thank you. And don't, Kevin BX is better than me. So don't.
I didn't say that.
He is.
No, you're a much better prospect.
All I'm saying is the VIP should be very excited for that. I'm really excited for that. Kevin is one of my favorites, and I'm glad that he finally, did he unblock you off Twitter? He unblocked me.
you know what I can't wait for? I can't wait for him to take a newspaper, roll it up, and smack Drancer over the nose every time Drancer tries to use a big word.
You guys have to ask him about that, about the whole the blocking people on Twitter thing. That'll be a funny conversation, I think.
All right, we'll do. He hasn't blocked me yet, so.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.